Please be seated, and Ms. Harrell, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Good morning, Judge Wilkinson, and may it please the court. I'm Emily Harrell. I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Yacome. And Mr. Yacome has raised some arguments regarding the challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, but I'd like to focus my arguments on the jury instruction issue, which I'm sure that what you're primarily interested in. Assuming that the plain error standard of review applies, Mr. Yacome, and of course by extension Mr. Flores-Reyes.
Is it plain error or invited error, or both plain error and invited error?
I don't think it can be invited error for a couple of reasons.
What am I supposed to do with the statement that the counsel made, oh, you don't need to re-instruct the jury orally? What am I supposed to do with that?
I don't think it can be considered invited error because...
Well, why wouldn't that imply that the instructions were okay?
Well, the instructions...
Or that any errors were really of a trivial nature.
The problem you face, Your Honor, is there is absolutely no way to know whether the correction that the judge made that was placed in the written instructions was actually relied upon or read by the jurors once they were provided the written instructions.
Honestly, you know, this is a lengthy jury trial and about a set of perfectly appalling murders. And you want us to reverse the entire result of that trial based on less than two lines of text in 70 pages of written instructions, and we had just to take the entire effort that's been put into the trial, the seating of the jury, the calling of witnesses, the jury's deliberations, and throw that aside and because of two lines and a 70-page opinion?
I believe it's warranted, Your Honor, because it is a fatal variance, and it's a possibility that the jury could have convicted him on the lesser offense of conspiracy based on the court's instruction.
But we're talking about the oral instructions here.
That's
the written
correct.
The ones had the correct information in it.
Again, I'll emphasize, Your Honor, there's no way to know whether those written instructions, which contained the correct,
was it objected to? I mean, when you think about the practical effect of when you see something, everybody's in the court. Now, you are suggesting the jury heard all this, and nobody really picked up on it until eventually one of the defense counsel picked up on one, government picked up on the other one, and brought it out. And it would have been, the judge seems to me, was very careful in this case. Took his time and gave the opportunity to respond. No one asked him to go back and re-instruct the jury on those charges. You probably didn't need any more instruction on that. It didn't need more emphasis on it. Certainly not the defense counsel. And it's an odd case, and I think Judge Wilkinson's alluded to the fact you got 70 pages. Took 2.5 hours to read it. that would be challenging to me, at least, to do that. And he did emphasize listen, because you do hear it. But he was given copies of the instructions. And in those, I mean, the written stuff is right there. If anybody had any confusion, I mean, I could hear one of the jurors says, oh, he said this, but, well, it's written right here. You know, that would be there. I just don't know of a case like this in which you have this kind of corrective behavior, but you are saying he corrected it, but not enough, is what it sounds like to me.
Yes, Your Honor. I think certently Rule 30 provides, and the case law that I cited in my reply brief provides, that corrections to instructions should be given in open court so that not only the defendant and attorney have a chance to read and hear and assess the instruction given, but also...
The judge said that the written instructions were to be the definitive ones.
There's nothing in this case, Your Honor.
And the other thing is, you make a big deal about conspiracy here, but these folks weren't just conspiring to commit these horrific murders. They were in it up to their eyeballs, and there's a wealth of evidence before the jury that these three individuals were either principals in these horrific homicides or at best were still aiders and abettors. They weren't conspirators. They were people who were in it and up to it and killed in order to get a promotion and ingratiate themselves with their superiors in a perfectly deadly enterprise. And the jury saw that, and the probability that they convicted them on a conspiracy count as opposed to seeing their active involvement in these horrible acts, the probability that the jury went that direction is between zero and nil.
Respectfully, Judge Wilkinson, I disagree. I think that there is sufficient evidence, particularly as to Mr. Yacome, where he could have been convicted based on a conspiracy offense. He's only indicted as to this and implicated in this one offense. And there's plenty of evidence that one could take to establish his involvement in a conspiracy. So I would take a different tact on that.
You mean as opposed to aiding and abetting?
Yes, sir.
I thought Yacome went to the scene and actually participated.
He did, but there, if the jury were to disregard that, they could also say he was involved in the conspiracy of planning.
How do you disregard the vivid description of what took place? Is this, what is it, 14-year-old person who was talking to the police and had to be taken out? Is that the issue? I mean, he was knifed, and did Yacome actually himself apply some knife wounds to the child?
Your Honor, there were some knives involved, and there was...
Was there evidence that Yacome himself applied some knife wounds?
Actually, no, Your Honor. The evidence...
I thought that after they were killing him, he came on and he himself did some.
There's... And I hate to get down into the nitty-gritty details.
Well, that's what the jury heard, you know.
There was a machete involved, yeah. And there were knives involved. And the government star witness specifically talked about two different instruments. And he talked about the Katra, the government star witness, talked about his and Mr. Yacome's involvement with the machete, which he said they used to strike the victim. And as Mr. Yacome also attempted to strangle him, the handle broke. The other individuals involved in...
So you don't think that was participating? I mean, you think he thought he was just trying to injure this young man?
My position is that those could be taken as part of an assault, that as part of a corte assault. So that would be my position.
Wasn't it a rule of MS-13 that this 14-year-old would have to be killed?
It was a rule, and
Yacome was he a homeboy at that point?
He was a homeboy, but there's no evidence, and I think that there is evidence that perhaps he became a homeboy without committing a murder. So my thought would be...
Well, I'm not talking about whether he achieved homeboy, but he was a homeboy status, which is a pretty high up in that organization. And he's in the car, he's going down to the scene, and the rule is that this young man has to be killed, and he gets in there with a machete or whatever, and he's trying to choke him around the neck, obviously to carry out the rule. I mean, I don't quite understand where you would argue that a jury is considering simply a conspiracy charge here.
I think there's sufficient evidence to establish his involvement in a conspiracy. If you take the...
Well, sure. Every crime that's actually committed has inherent a conspiracy because you're planning to do it. But the fact that it was actually done in this case...
If you take the position that his homeboy status in the organization established that he would be involved in... carrying out the need to eliminate...
But Judge Niemeyer makes a good point, does he not? That a great many people who commit a crime, not everyone, but a great many people talk about it beforehand, but that doesn't mean that the jury could have convicted them of a conspiracy when they went a great deal farther than talking about it or conspiring about it or whatever. And it's the actuality of what happened here, not the some sort of conspiratorial planning that was front and center before the jury. That's what they heard. They heard... And a lot of it was kept out because the trial judge didn't want to run across a 403 problem. But what the jury heard was not about conspiracy. The jury heard about the commission of the crime, not the conspiracy to commit, but the commission. It's a tough case. It's a tough case for you, but that doesn't lessen my appreciation.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Goldman, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Peter Goldman on behalf of Breon Alexander Contreras-Avalos. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. May it please the court. I'm going to be brief. I've asked for brief time, and I would like to just review with the court, pursuant to my argument, 3 points. The first, I think it's worthwhile to review the standard and the interplay between Rule 29A and Rule 33A. Quoting from this court's case in Souder, which references this court's decision in United States versus Wilson, 118 Fed 3rd 228 from 1997, reading from Souder, contrary to the government's suggestion, however, Wilson does not hold that a trial court is foreclosed from granting a motion for a new trial in every case where the evidence is legally sufficient to support a jury's verdict. And while Wilson teaches that, quote, a district court should exercise its discretion to grant a new trial sparingly, and that the district court should grant a new trial based on the weight of evidence only when the evidence weighs heavily against the verdict, we evaluate such a ruling against the backdrop of the district court's broad power to independently weigh the evidence when considering such a motion, as well as the deferential standard of review we must apply to that decision. My point being that, unlike Rule 29A on a Rule 33A motion, the district court can and should make its own credibility determinations and review the evidence. Now, this court reviews the district court's denial of the 33A motion on an abuse of discretion standard. With that said, the next point I'd like to make very simply is, and that relates my 2 points, I'd like to read very briefly what began this trial, which was the testimony of the government's handpicked expert, Sergeant Ricardo Guzman from the Houston Police Department, about the credibility and the need for corroboration of MS-13 cooperators. question. And also, getting back to when they lied to you as law enforcement, you have learned that it's best to not just rely on their word, correct? Answer, that's right. Question, and to seek other evidence that can corroborate one way or the other what they are saying. Answer, yes, ma'am. That was the government's expert that began this case. I have very little time, so briefly, I think, and you've read the brief, my argument very simply, the case against Mr. Contreras of Valos was not based on any physical or forensic evidence. The government, and this was a six-year investigation, the government had numerous government attorneys, FBI, DEA agents, crime scene investigators, police DNA investigators, and other federal and state personnel. But in this case, there was the government was unable to produce any physical evidence, forensic evidence, weapons, drugs, DNA evidence.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
We appreciate it.
I'll reserve a word for rebuttal.
You have reserved a minute for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
We'll hear from you. Mr. Sachs, let's hear your view.
Thank you. May it please the court. Ethan Sachs on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start briefly with the jury instruction issue we've been talking about. I think Your Honor's discussion with my friend on the other side really gets to the key issues here. Just to clarify, Moore is the case that we think lays out when an error in the jury instruction can rise to a constructive amendment. What Moore says is you consider the totality of the circumstances and whether those circumstances would allow a reasonable jury.
Well, this issue comes up occasionally, but other circuits have faced what were alleged to be variances between written and oral instructions. And when the written instructions were submitted and were conveyed to be definitive, as I understand it, the other circuits have said that there's certainly no plain error in those sorts of circumstances. So I think if we were to say that there was a fatal variance in what happened here, that we would be creating a circuit split in terms of the way that other circuits have approached this question about, because, you know, it's not an unusual thing for written instructions, of course, aren't always given, but where they are, it's not an unusual thing that they don't parrot verbatim what was said in court. And if any little difference there was thought to be some kind of fatal variance, that would be a pretty unsettling holding. See what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. We agree with that completely, especially in light of the context of how minor the mistake here was. I mean, it was two words or references to the word conspiracy, and as Your Honor's alluded to earlier.
My friend Judge Wynn said, and that is you cannot read the record here and go over this without being impressed with the manner in which Judge Zenas handled this trial. She's a very good judge, I might add. And she, notwithstanding the horrific nature of these crimes, she bent over backwards to make certain that there was a fair trial here, as she should have done. And sometimes you like to respect good work on the part of the district judges. They value their craft as much as we value ours. And this district judge did a fine job.
Well, we agree, Your Honor, that the judge here was very thorough in the district court and understanding of all objections. And in fact, This issue only came to rise because the district court judge, after reading the jury instructions, elicited comments from both sides and ensured that there wasn't anything substantial or serious enough worth to recall the jury. So I think we agree that throughout the trial, the judge was conscientious and aware of any potential concerns, and certainly none arose to the level of the Fifth Amendment.
Judge Neumeier, do you have any further questions on that? We have no further questions. We thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Ms. Harrell?
Just briefly, Your Honor. You mentioned several courts looking at the issue of jury instructions and perhaps finding plain error or not. I guess I would say that the error exists in the fact that there's absolutely no way to determine whether the jury read and relied on the instructions.
Well, sure, there's a way to determine. You can look at the evidence that was presented to the jury.
And there's specific findings. They made some specific findings in this case.
They made specific findings as to count one.
Yes.
And I believe my position on that would be the counts are to be considered separately.
Of course.
And so I don't think you can automatically transfer the finding made on count one to the Vicar murder on count five.
Didn't the district judge, and I'm asking you, I can't remember, did the district judge go through the different counts and explain the different counts?
Yes, and that's where the error arose.
The court did not include a Pinkerton count, right?
I'm sorry?
The court did not include a conspiracy count.
Correct, as to count five.
I'm talking about all counts.
She did include a Pinkerton count as related to count one. So she included that charge there, but then the whole issue arose at the charge conference because the government also wanted a Pinkerton charge as to count five, and counsel objected, and then it evolved into an Apprendi issue. Well, if I include this conspiracy language, then I've really got to consider whether we're creating an Apprendi issue. And so they agreed to take it out. And then there was an inadvertent inclusion of it in the charge that she read to the jury the next day on count five. So that's where the error was.
I know where the error was, but I'm trying to put myself in the position. You're focusing heavily on the oral presentation, and it was a lengthy presentation. And traditionally, and I must say, I confess I didn't go back and look at the beginning, but usually the judge outlines the various counts that are being presented to the jury and describes them generally and then does it in more detail later. But I was asking whether that was done in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. In her opening charge, like at the very beginning of the trial, she just gave a very brief overview of counts, obviously. But then when she went to charge the jury, and she charged before they presented closing argument. So when she charged the jury as to all of the counts, she did include a Pinkerton charge as related to count one. But again, I would just circle back very quickly to the fact that even though the jury made those findings, you have no way of knowing whether they read and relied on the corrected instruction they were given. She didn't poll the jury when they came back in. Contrary to the government's argument in their brief, she didn't tell them, hey, rely primarily on these written instructions. Those things did not happen. So, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Goldman?
Your Honors, briefly, from Mr. Contreras-Avalos's point of view, the record of this case is very strange. The entire conviction of the evidence against my client was based on the testimony of cooperators, which I realize that there was
I understand. You know, the jury knew this, and as much hay could be made of it, The jury makes the assessment. You and I both could make the assessment. We know this is a hardened criminal that's testifying, and we conclude he's testifying because he's going to get a break. And so the cross-examination goes like, well, how do we know you're truthful now? I mean, this type of thing. The jury makes that assessment, and there was plenty of evidence that oral evidence. I mean, you obviously would like some forensic evidence presented, but that isn't totally unusual.
Correct, Your Honor. You're right. What is unusual about this case is that the government's expert, the first witness of the case, said these people, cooperators, cannot be believed without corroboration. That corroboration is not in the record of this case against my client. We respectfully submit, I agree with you.
That's his opinion. I mean, if a jury believes them, the jury believes them. He says, oh, you can't believe them because they're criminals. They've been at this a long time. They're in a very lethal gang. They've done some very bad things, and they're in here testifying, trying to save their soul. So the expert says, don't trust them unless they're corroborated. Well, that doesn't bind that person. Doesn't even bind the jury.
It doesn't bind the jury. I respectfully submit it creates a problematic record to convict.
I don't even know if it's problematic. It seems to me that's like an expert saying, basically, be careful. These people are criminals. They were involved in all of this, and they're now trying to save their skins. This is what the jury knows and has to assess, but that doesn't deny a person evaluating the testimony based on how it's said, what's said, how the witness acts, how it's consistent with other witnesses' testimony, how it's consistent with the overall structure of the case. These things the jury sees, and it doesn't look like they had much trouble on this case.
I appreciate the court's position. If I could just make Judge Wilkinson one other
point.
Sure. Thank you, sir. In addition to, I think, that the government's case collides with itself, when the one expert presented in the case said, I always have to corroborate these people's information because they're not believable, there's also just a basic logic and common sense problem. How could my client, Mr. Contreras-Avalos, be involved in this gang for 6 years, doing all these allegedly horrific things, and out of that alleged criminal activity, and with this legion of investigators and resources the government threw at this and had testify, how could it not produce any physical or forensic evidence?
All you have to do is look at the whole history of the mafia convictions and prosecutions. I mean, the leaders of these organizations isolate themselves. The big drug conspiracies we have, the heads of them usually don't even touch the drugs. It's the way these operations operate, and this is something for the jury to assess and for the evidence to be presented. Now, if there's not enough evidence to hold them in, the jury will they're sufficiently informed about it. I'm sure you informed them well about it. But it seemed to me that it's hard to get the leaders of these organizations who isolate themselves from the actual conduct. They'll flick their finger and give the green light, and two people are killed upon sight. And they say, oh, you can't get him who flicked his finger for the green light because there's no forensic evidence. As a matter of fact, he didn't even say kill him. He just went like this. This is the green light. That's the way they operate.
I understand, Your Honor. I appreciate the court's position. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I see you're court appointed. I mentioned earlier it was a tough case, but I'm all the more appreciative for your willingness to step forward and provide what I think is a very able defense. So thank you both. You really do have the court's appreciation, and we'll come down and we'll adjourn court and come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning. God save the United States and this honorable court.